first speaker is Chris Solik, and he's talking about the San Gabriel River Regional Monitoring Program.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. As Becca said, I'm here to talk about the San Gabriel River Monitoring Program. This was a project I was involved with as a side project while conducting my dissertation fieldwork on the San Gabriel River in Southern California. And before I begin, I want to acknowledge this was a very collaborative process, and many people were involved in this, but especially these individuals and these organizations were instrumental in getting this program off the ground. So I want to acknowledge them right off the bat. Just a little background on the program. Well, it's a water quality monitoring program. We know that, but it's at the watershed scale. What makes it unique is it integrates ambient compliance monitoring, which is permit-mandated monitoring of water quality, and any volunteer monitoring that was being conducted in the watershed. And it's using a multi-indicator approach to assess watershed condition. And this is important. I'll talk a little bit more about that. A little history. Program was developed in 2004, implemented in 2005. The development was motivated initially by a permit through the LA County Sanitation District. These are mitigation funds. This was developed the program. Implementation was through permit offsets, or the money that would be saved from implementation of the program, from money saved from monitoring, in-kind support, and a lot of coordination with when the sampling occurred. A little bit on the watershed. It's in eastern Los Angeles County in Southern California, about 700 square miles, and it's located between the much larger Santa Ana watershed and the more probably better known Los Angeles River watershed. It's a dual watershed in two respects. It's natural in the upper areas and urban and channelized in the lower watershed. And I think this map really shows that dichotomy of the upper watershed being undeveloped and an intensely urbanized lower watershed. Just some quick photographs of the upper watershed. It's in the Angeles National Forest in the San Gabriel Mountains. Some very pristine sites, surprisingly, considering its close proximity to an urban area. The main stem of the river, flow is in the summer, it only comes from urban runoff sources, wastewater discharge treatment plants, and imported water from the State Water Project. Mediterranean River, typically in the summer, there is no flow, only flow during the winter period. And in the lower watershed, the most altered area of the watershed, anyone who's been to Southern California can really relate to what most of this area looks like in this area. Not a whole lot. So what were the issues with existing monitoring? Well, there was a lot going on, 6 agencies, 3 citizens groups, but nothing was coordinated. There was a lack of coordination of what was being measured. The quality assurance methodologies were not coordinated, and this really limited data comparability. And inefficiencies in the program were redundancies between monitoring programs where they monitored, and a majority of the watershed was not monitored at all. And this illustrates where the monitoring was being conducted prior to the program development. 2 areas where treated wastewater discharge is being released into the river, and at estuary monitoring sites looking at mass emissions to the San Gabriel River estuary. And this is all, and you can see most of it was unmonitored at that time. So development of the program was fairly straightforward, we thought. Stakeholders got together, developed the specific monitoring questions looking at ambient conditions. Do we want to look at trends, health, or is it just compliance? So these people got together, and we assessed our ability to answer these questions with the resources that we had, and this developed the San Gabriel River Monitoring Program. We coordinated with existing state ambient monitoring programs that were already in place. We already had methodologies. And with any program, we wanted to be adaptive and modify the program as needed. Looked great on paper, but when you have multiple stakeholders involved in the process, a little easier said than done. But we did finally get to the point where we formulated 5 monitoring questions that satisfied this group of stakeholders. And the first question, really getting at those ambient conditions, watershed health, trends over time, looked at the second question, got at that. Compliance was addressed through the third, and the fourth and fifth looked at human health issues. And this satisfied that large group of stakeholders that you saw at the previous slide. So I'm focusing mainly on question 1, maybe a little bit on 2 today. This was a different slide. We're going to pass over that slide. So watershed health, the ambient monitoring. It was a probability-based design, random allocation of sites. These sites change each year, 30 the first year, 10 new sites the year after that. There are three areas of interest: the upper watershed tributaries, the lower watershed tributaries, and the main stem. This was coordinated with the ongoing statewide programs. It's the swamp, the surface water, ambient monitoring program design, again, already in place at the time, and monitoring once a year in the spring. For our trends at unique sites, we had a small number of key fixed sites, three categories we were interested: high use, high ecological value areas, confluence points, and pristine areas in the upper watershed. Monitoring based on what category we were addressing, what the question was at the time. Was it stream condition or water chemistry? Again, monitoring once in the spring. So our ambient assessment year one, 30 random sites stratified by the upper watershed, main stem, and then everything else was considered lower watershed. So these are all our sampling sites, eight targeted sites, and you can see the triangles looking at the targeted sites. A lot of local partners helped with this, and we were also able to piggyback on the swamp program at the time and get these areas sampled by swamp for that first year of monitoring. Lots of coordination and collaboration, just to give you an idea of what it takes to get this type of program off the ground. And our methods, we use traditional approaches. The traditional triad approach looked at water chemistry, looked at water toxicity, and bioassessment. But we also included something called the California Rapid Assessment Method, just to augment standard techniques. It's what its name implies, a rapid assessment method, really focused more on riparian vegetation, though. And it's the multiple indicator approach I wanted to emphasize again is what we were trying to achieve with this program. Field data collection, my personal favorite part of the whole process. So significant results, we'll actually go to this one. Using copper as a surrogate for the metals, and this is what the trends that we had in the lower watershed is metals tended to be the highest in the lower watershed sites. And this was due to the location of storm drains. Metals were entering the system via storm drains. So metals look like this across the board. As for nutrients, a little different picture emerges. The main stem was the main source of nutrients. And this is where the wastewater, the treated wastewater was being released into the river. So of course this makes sense. And then, looking at bioassessment data, Allison talked a little bit about the index of biotic integrity. Well, of course, this makes sense. The lower areas, the more impacted parts of the watershed, had a lower bioassessment score, or IBI score, and the upper watershed had the higher scores. But you can see there is variation amongst sites within the upper watershed and even in the lower watershed. But nothing too surprising. And also, we were able to look at correlations between index of biotic integrity and CRAM, again, emphasizing that multiple indicator approach. And they do correlate very nicely with each other. Just looking at species abundance by site, looking at the aquatic macroinvertebrates, the taxa groups are listed on this left-hand column, and the site groups are listed here. And I don't expect you to be able to read any of this, but just looking at the variation of the different taxa that are found in the lower watershed versus what is found in the upper watershed, they do vary by site and by species groups. And nothing surprising here, but just remember, before this program was implemented, we could not say this about the watershed as a whole. And this was, again, the ambient conditions. So this is the first time we could actually show this from real data on this watershed. And again, looking at macroinvertebrates, the functional feeding groups, more functional feeding groups, higher aquatic habitat, and that's exactly what we found. Again, nothing new here, upper watershed, more functional feeding groups, main stem, lower watershed, more depauperate. But again, we can actually say this with data that was collected and standardized the same way. Overall health of streams, it really depends on how you define impairment in streams, what people are interested in impairment. Do you do it just by copper, just by general toxicity, just by bioassessment, or by the CRAM? And you can see the percent miles of stream impaired on the y-axis, that percentage really changes depending on which parameter you use to measure. If you're just looking at copper, the situation doesn't look too bad. But if you have even just general toxicity, all metals, it even looks even better. But you get into things like bioassessment and the California Rapid Assessment Method, the percentage of impaired streams really increases. So again, looking at multiple indicators, how important they are to have that whole gamut of assessment methods. And again, just following up on that, just looking at the two indicators, using only two, impairment percentage of impaired streams looks much higher, but looking at all four indicators, the situation is not as bad. More information, the better way we're able to assess the quality of the water, of the aquatic habitat. And some obvious benefits of this integrated design, these multiple indicators provide more robust assessment and ability to look at some of those correlations between the different metrics and address a range of questions to really satisfy a large group of stakeholders who have an interest in vested interest in water quality. The ambient assessment provides a context for other types of monitoring, the trend over time, and this will get more powerful as more data is collected year after year. Of course, the shared data synthesis and interpretation, allowing for the collaborative state of the watershed reports that will now be possible with this program in place. And of course, increased efficiency, the standardized methods. We can compare data now throughout the watershed. And probably one of the nicer parts of this was the increased program efficiency, the less sampling, the elimination of sites, and the modification of protocols led to a $400,000 a year cost savings. This implements the program on an ongoing basis, so it's self-sustaining now, just with this change in coordination. So we're very happy about that. So the status, third year of the monitoring, this year, it's a fully implemented program at this point. QAPP, a quality assurance plan, is in place, and the Los Angeles and San Gabriel Watershed Council is now managing this program with continued stakeholder input, and annual reports will be produced with this. And the Watershed Council manages this. And next steps is to continue implementing it because that internal funding mechanism is in place, and to implement this in other watersheds in the region. Hopefully next year this will begin. And with that, some questions, and I do encourage you to visit the Los Angeles San Gabriel Watershed Council website, and this report's online. There's even data available that we collected from this program, and there's so many people to thank, but thank you.
And actually, the next person cannot be here. I'll explain why in a minute. So if it goes over a little bit, that's fine. So who's got some questions?
Yes.
One is, it sounds like there's some funding for continuing this type of monitoring. For other areas that may not have funding, what is your sense for sort of the most cost-effective of those? Is that rapid? I don't know very much about the actual
In other areas that maybe don't have the mitigation funds, most of the sanitation districts in other counties, they do. They are putting wastewater into most rivers, so there are mitigation funds available, usually in most cases, and you're really using this as a template to do that in other areas. So the funding mechanism's there. It was the coordination that people didn't want to really take the time to get these people together. And that was the largest part of this, was just that coordination. That's why I was trying to emphasize that. Does that answer?
Yeah. A little bit?
Yes. Could you give some reasons why it was so successful? These programs have failed all over the country. Why did this one work?
I think it really went down to the main group involved with this was the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. It's a group of researchers. It's focused on water quality issues. They really were at the helm of this. And I think one particular individual, Eric Stein, really saw this through. He put a lot of effort into coordinating these work group meetings. And it really was the work group meetings, I think, that people were, the counties, the cities that were involved. They had very good representatives on them. And these people were consistently coming to these meetings, learning what had to be done. And when they found out that the funding was possible, it was a fairly easy process. Generally, they liked the idea. So it was the people involved.
Recently, I went to a talk by Tyrone Hayes, and he worked at Berkeley, and he recently has been giving talks on anthracene in the water supply. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, did you all measure such things, and then did you have any sort of backlash about that?
No, there's so many constituents were measured for this.
Like in the toxicity, did you herbicide, pesticide?
And then something I didn't mention, toxicity was extremely low in this watershed. Only 7% of samples, only two sites out of all 30 were actually toxic to the aquatic organisms, to the invertebrates, or the fish that we tested. So very extremely low levels of toxicity. The nutrients were a little bit wasn't a big issue for us.
How is this now impacting the agency? Has it changed a lot of how these agencies are managing these watersheds, or mostly just the monitoring?
No, it's all the building monitoring in place now. It's transparent, so people are just going through the motions now. It's self-perpetuating. So people are monitoring just like they always did. They're just only monitoring in a different area, a little more coordination. So it really hasn't changed things. I think that, going back to what Vince asked, it really helped that people didn't have to change too much to what they were doing on a daily basis. It kind of just seamlessly coordinated and stuff that way.
Out of personal curiosity, you said that you play a small role in this, and you know it's just kind of a side project. But how does it tie into your overall work,
dissertation?
Your dissertation?
A lot of when did a lot of physical habitat data in the upper watershed. All my study sites, they were exactly where we sampled for this. So all of that physical habitat, the bioassessment data that was collected, is going directly into my dissertation on aquatic ecology. So it was a really nice integration.
Any other questions?